Illinois had the most car crash fatalities in 2016 in almost a decade. The Illinois Department of Transportation joins us today to talk about what they're doing to prevent more accidents from happening this year. Also,
four of the largest insurers in Illinois have increased premiums from 3% to 8% this year.
That's CBS Chicago's Dorothy Tucker. We'll discuss why auto rates have gone up with a reporter from Crane Chicago Business, and Allstate Insurance joins us as well. Later, we speak with a Holocaust survivor about her experience being separated from her family at age 10 and subject to human experimentation at a Nazi concentration camp.
I was lowered to the lowest form of human existence. I could not let the Nazis win.
That's Eva Moses Korn, a trailer for an upcoming documentary about her life. She joins us to talk about her journey of forgiveness and share the work she's doing at the Candles Holocaust Museum in Terre Haute, Indiana. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Hope everyone's staying safe out on the roads today. Lots of snowy conditions. We're going to be talking about that in a little bit. But first, we're going to be talking about car insurance. I don't know if you've noticed a rise in your rates. In October, for example, State Farm implemented their highest rate hike in 14 years. On average, the company raised their rates 5.9% for their auto insurance customers. In a minute, we're going to be speaking with a representative from Allstate about their own rate hikes. But first, let's start with Steve Daniels. He's a reporter with Crane Chicago Business. He's been covering this issue recently. Steve, welcome back to the 21st. Happy New Year. Thanks for being with us.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Steve, when did we start seeing insurance rates begin rising across the board in Illinois? About a month or two ago?
No, longer ago than that. But insurers began stepping up rates sort of bit by bit a year and a half ago or so. And it was due at the time to a sort of a sudden and somewhat inexplicable, at least back then, increase in their the accidents that they were seeing their insured, their policyholders get into, as well as the costs associated with those. But the increase that was very notable recently was the one by State Farm, since State Farm insures so many people and typically hasn't raised rates that dramatically in this state. As you said, it's been 14 years since they did that.
Right. I should mention,
they insure so many people, it has such an impact.
Right. So I know they insure about one in three drivers in Illinois are insured by State Farm. I should mention that we reached out to them to join us on the show. They declined to join us. They did pass along this statement that claim costs continue to rise in Illinois. They've been rising for several years. This is what State Farm said. As a result, we're implementing a rate change to better cover expected claim costs. The state is also dealing with trends seen across the U.S. and across the auto insurance industry. We attribute much of the shift in loss trends to several factors, including distracted driving, more drivers on the road, newer, higher value vehicles, and rising vehicle repair and medical costs. Steve, I think people might be curious about that, because I would tend to think that those things, isn't that kind of the point of insurance, that more expensive vehicles, isn't that factored into the cost of insurance when you're buying it to begin with?
Yeah, it is, but insurance is something of a science, but as much of an art. And the actuarial process of trying to set rates is trying to predict, exactly what your costs are going to be, and build in maybe a slight margin of profit on, in terms of your actual insurance operations, the costs that you pay out and how much you have to pay your people and everything else versus the cost of the claims that you pay to cover policyholders. The way the insurance business works is you want to make a little bit of a profit on that, and then take the money that is that's floating around, because you're an insurance company and people are paying premiums all the time, and invest that wisely and well, and make a lot of your profit that way. But almost every property casualty insurance company wants to make at least a small profit on the actual insurance. And when they don't, they tend to react this way.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring in Megan Sporletter from Allstate Insurance, based in Northbrook, Illinois. Megan is a spokesperson there for Allstate. Megan, thank you for being with us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we mentioned, Megan, State Farm Insurance customers saw a 5.9% rise on average in October. But last June, Allstate customers saw a 6.9% rate hike. Why are you seeing, as you've been listening to this conversation that Steve and I have been having, why is Allstate raising rates? What is the reasoning behind you all having to raise rates for your customers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard the statement that you read from State Farm, and that is very much aligned with what we're seeing here at Allstate. In 2015, we broke a twenty-year trend in fewer crashes. So, if you think about 20 years back, manufacturers are building safer cars. Graduated driver's licensing laws were becoming more and more strict. So, you had fewer young drivers with little to no experience. Right, that was much more structured in terms of what needed to happen for a young driver to get their license. And also over the past 20 years, we've seen things like tougher drunk driving laws and more laws to keep people safe on the road. And then in 2015, we saw the perfect storm. We saw that it became more affordable to drive. So gas prices were down. More cars were on the road. Car sales were up and unemployment was down. And we were seeing more distracted drivers. So as all of those factors came together, we really broke that trend and saw record increases in crashes and in fatalities.
Now, would the cost go up then, as you're talking about smart cars and technology, would the cost go up for specifically if you, I mean, it would make sense the newer your car, the more expensive your insurance is, but is it cost going up mostly for drivers who have smart cars, or is it everybody because as you're talking about crashes and distracted driving and those sorts of things?
Mm-hmm. So we base our rates on a variety of factors, right? Where you live, age, how many people live in your household, what kind of car you drive is one of those things. But again, as you were mentioning, you know, think about a bumper 10 years ago, just essentially, you know, a piece of metal, where as now we have these bumpers that have sensors, they have cameras, and they're much more expensive to replace. So you're right, smart cars is one factor. But again, I want to highlight that between that and the rising costs of injuries and medical costs, and then also, of course, it's more people on the road, that's going to increase the number of crashes that occur.
Mm-hmm. Megan, for your customers or for everyone, what advice do you give them for seeking out the lowest rates for insurance while obviously, of course, maintaining safe coverage?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we encourage customers to work with their local Allstate agent or their local insurance agent, no matter what company they have, given that every household really has unique needs and risks and things that they value and that they need to protect. So insurance is such an individualized conversation that we really encourage consumers to seek local advice, and that might be ensuring that you have all the discounts you're entitled to or doing things that can enable you to get more discounts. That could mean looking around at different deductible options that your provider offers. So a local agent can lead a consumer through that conversation and help determine what's best for them and their family.
Allstate is based in Northbrook, Illinois. I want to thank spokesperson Megan Sporletter for being with us. Megan, thanks.
Thank you.
Steve Daniels, you've covered this issue for Cranes for some time. I wonder, as you look at this year ahead, how competitive is the insurance market? Are we seeing, if everybody's raising rates across the board, it's kind of one of those things where for consumers, it's not like you can be shopping around for cheaper insurance, right?
Well, I think it always behooves people who are looking, especially in a rising rate environment, to shop around. We didn't mention, you know, we're talking about Allstate and State Farm. Both of those are companies that sell through agents. There's a lot of companies that sell directly over the Internet. You know, Geico is the best known of those and ubiquitous on the air in terms of its ads that promise lower rates than, you know, the Allstates and the State Firms of the world. You know, they've been raising rates aggressively as well. So it is, you know, Geico ran into the same problem. This was an across-the-board issue for all of these companies. That what Megan described last year, all of them experienced in one way or another, and it wasn't just in Illinois, it was all over the country. You know, some states are worse than others, and it's a bit of a mystery, some of it, as to why some of it's bad in some places and not so bad in others, but the basic trends were all there. And so I do think that, you know, different companies price their risks differently. So what you said about people being individually assessed is accurate as well. A Geico might charge your next door neighbor a lot more than charge you for reasons that have to do with, you know, your credit score, all kinds of things.
Your credit score, your driving record, your age, those sorts of things, apart from just the vehicle, right? Sure.
Correct. All kinds of things get taken into account. So I do think it behooves people to shop around.
How often do you think people should do that? I'm just curious. Is that kind of a once a year thing, more often than that?
Well, it kind of depends really a lot on your budget and you know, your financial situation and things like that. You know, I don't think it's something that, generally speaking, people want to do. It's a pain.
Right, it's a pain. It's no one wants to deal with car insurance.
You don't want to think. Yeah, you don't want to think about it, really, as best, you know. And so a lot of times I think the choice comes down to, well, you know, certainly the way State Farm and Allstate will market themselves is you're going to pay a little bit more to insure your car with us than you will with Geico or Progressive or others. But, you know, when you get in trouble, we're going to cover you. There's not going to be a lot of hassle. There's not going to be a lot of, now, of course, this isn't always the case, but certainly I think State Farm has enjoyed a very strong reputation along those lines. Is you actually have a problem, we're going to cover you. We're not going to argue with you. We're not going to nickel and dime you. So there's something, you know, there's a value in that. People will, you know, we'll look at that as a factor as well as just simple, you know, it's like you don't notice. Generally speaking, these guys will raise your rates 2 or 3% at a time. You don't notice it, or if you do, you might happen to accidentally look at, you know,
right. This has been unusual, what
ago.
We've seen right in the past 6 months. It's something people would notice, right?
I think a 6% increase in your premiums at State Farm will be noticeable because they're fairly pricey as it is. So, you know, you're gonna wonder and maybe ask your agent, hey, what's the deal here?
That's Steve Daniels covering insurance with Crane Chicago Business. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to jump now to the Illinois Department of Transportation. We were talking about distracted driving. Last year, actually, Illinois had the most fatalities from car accidents since 2007. There were 1,076 deaths on Illinois' roadways in 2016. That's nearly three lives lost on the road every day. Priscilla Tobias is an assistant chief engineer with IDOT, the Illinois Department of Transportation. Priscilla, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Priscilla, I'm sure you've heard a little bit of that conversation. Why did we see an increase in deaths in 2016 on Illinois roads?
You know, there's, I think, several factors, you know, and they were mentioned, I think, gas prices being lower, you know, so people are getting out traveling more. One of the things, too, is unemployment rates are down. And, you know, what the data suggests is when unemployment rates are down and people have more money, then they're on the roads. And so you have more exposure, more traffic crashes. And so those all tied together. The other thing, too, you know, the last couple of winters have been really much milder. I think about a couple years ago, it seemed like every couple days we'd get a foot of snow and then get really cold. But the milder winters, even the less snow that we get, it means you've got
more people on the roads.
Mm-hmm. Yes, motorcycles, pedestrians are out. Motorcycles are out longer. And so, you know, those more at risk, I'll say roadway users, are exposed. And then the distracted driving is definitely, and that's texting and drowsy driving, those are becoming a bigger issue. And then we did see a slight decrease in seatbelt use this year. And that is one area that, again, we think that can impact.
Wow, that's surprising. All right, so everyone needs to remember to put their seatbelts on. That's a pretty basic thing. Priscilla, what structural and engineering tactics is IDOT doing to reduce traffic accidents?
Well, you know, each year we go through and we do our mostly data analysis to look at the trends and identify those roadways that have a higher potential for safety improvement, and then we'll look at doing roadway improvements there. But then this year we're rolling out, we've been coordinating with state police to implement like these Wolfpack patrols.
What's that?
So these, you end up having like one officer that'll do the kind of the they'll they'll be there and they'll watch motorists pass and they'll go, oh, they're just, you know, they're texting or they're speeding or whatever that may be as far as illegal traffic maneuvers. And then they will call ahead to officers. So we'll have, like, let's say 5 to 6 officers out there, and they can call ahead and say, hey, this blue car, license plate, blah, blah, blah. And then that officer ahead can pull them over. So it allows to kind of do this more mass enforcement. And so we did that around the state towards the tail end of the construction season as we were wrapping up. And our intent is to carry that through the winter months, like with our maintenance crews being out there. And then you'll see more of that in the spring and the summer. But we feel like it has a very strong, visible presence. And you can, like I said, do a lot of enforcement in a shorter period of time. And
would you say that, so would you say efforts are more focused on enforcement as opposed to education about seatbelts and those sorts of things?
Actually, no. You know, the short term, you can do the enforcement, but we really feel like you need a multidiscipline approach, so you need to be looking at enforcement, education, engineering, and even the emergency medical services. How quickly can, if there is a crash, that you can respond to the scene and to any victims in that crash and then get them the treatment that they need, and that we can clear the scene as well to prevent any secondary crashes. Mm-hmm. So we try to look at, like I said, a multidiscipline, kind of multi-prong approach on safety. It just takes a little longer to get the engineering improvements. And like I said, we are doing the outreach as well. And we're hoping this year to address some of the issues like distracted driving,
safety. Right. Let's hope we improve that this year. Thanks to Priscilla Tobias, Assistant Chief Engineer from the Illinois Department of Transportation, reminding everybody, no distracted driving, wear your seatbelts. Thanks, Priscilla.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In the spring of 1944, a young girl, Eva Moses Kaur, was taken away from her family along with her twin sister. And in the months that followed, they, along with 1,500 other sets of twins, were placed on near-starvation diets, subjected to horrific human experimentation under the guidance of Nazi Dr. Joseph Mengele, who you may have heard of known as the Angel of Death. The experimentation lasted for 9 months, and of the 3,000 people who were in that concentration camp in Auschwitz, only an estimated 200 survived, but Eva Moses Kaur was one of them. She now lives in Terre Haute, Indiana. She's the founding director of the Candles Holocaust Museum, and she's on the line with us there from now from Terre Haute. Eva, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to share your story with us today.
Thank you very much, Nyla. I'm very glad to be with you.
Eva, you were just 10 years old when you and your family, you had three siblings and your parents. You
Correct.
You were ordered to board. We've heard the story of how people were forced into cattle cars. You were in that car for 4 days before you were met with Nazi soldiers. What do you remember from that day when you arrived at the camp?
It was early morning. We couldn't even see very well as the cattle car doors opened after 4 days. We were immediately rushed out, schnell, fast. And we, as we detrained or somehow got off the cattle car, which I don't exactly remember how it happened. One moment I was up, next moment I was on that cement platform. My mother was holding on to me and my twin sister Miriam. And I was very curious at age 10. And I just looked around to try to figure out what on earth is this place. And as I looked around, I realized that my father and my two older sisters disappeared in the crowd. And, of course, I never saw them again. Mm. It was probably the most godforsaken place I have ever seen. Confusion, pushing, people were yelling, shoving, dogs were barking, Nazis were yelling orders. No, I don't know how anybody could make any sense out of that place.
And one of the things they were shouting at you and your mother was that they asked your mother if you and your sister, if you were twins.
Yeah. Yeah, my mother didn't, we did not know. They were, yeah, once he asked, first they were yelling for twins, but we did not volunteer any information. Then he noticed us, the Nazi who was running on the selection platform. When he noticed us, he demanded to know if we were twins. And my mother asked, is that good? And the Nazi nodded yes, and my mother said yes. And then another Nazi came, pulled my mother in one direction. Our pleading and crying fell on deaf ears. And all I remember is seeing my mother's arms stretched out in despair as she was pulled away. It happened so fast that I didn't even think about saying goodbye to her, and I never got to say do so. Because they just pulled her in one direction. We were pulled in the opposite direction. Our crying and pleading fell on deaf ears, and that was the last time I saw her. May 1944.
So that day was the last day you saw your mother, your other sisters, and your father.
My father, correct.
So you and your sister, you're both 10 years old. You're in this camp, this horrible human experimentations. What do you remember from that time?
Well, I need to talk a little bit more about that because the arrival, once we were taken away from my mother, we became part of a group. In our group, there were 13 sets of little twin girls between the ages of 2 and 16. And I am sure on that selection platform, there were twin boys. And twin boys and twin girls were kept separated according to age and sex. So boys were in one barrack, girls were in another barrack. We were processed. That meant that our hair was cut short. We were tattooed. They heated a lamp and they heated a needle, a long needle with a handle over the flame of a lamp. And then when the needle got hot, they dipped it into ink and they burned into my left arm. Dot by dot, the capital letter A-7063. Miriam became capital A-7064. It's important to note that Auschwitz was the only Nazi camp that tattooed its inmates. My husband, who is a survivor of 4 years of Buchenwald, which was another big camp, he does not have a tattoo. Once we were processed, we were taken to our barrack. The conditions in the barrack was filthy, crude. The barrack was divided in two by a brick bench. On each side of the brick bench was a walkway and then the three-story high bunk bed. We have not been able to sleep much on the cattle car because we were crammed up like sardines. So there was no room really to sleep. We were just leaning against one another. So we thought it would be nice to be able to stretch out and sleep, but I couldn't sleep. Human beings cannot function under such a after such a horrific day as we experienced. But as I was turning and tossing and turning in my bed, I noticed something big and dark. They looked like very, very big mice. I began screaming. Then a girl from the top bunk bed said, "Silly kid, these are not mice, they are rats." So now we couldn't even go back to our bunk bed because we were on the bottom and the rats were parading right by there. We went to the latrine, and as I entered the latrine, there on the filthy floor were the scattered corpses of three children. I have never seen anybody dead. And I realized, so it hit me immediately, that in this place, children are dying. So I made a silent pledge that I will do anything and everything within my power to make sure that Miriam and I shall not end up on that filthy latrine floor. Mm,
you just said that was that first day. You decided that first day.
Because I arrived in Auschwitz as a very religious Jewish girl. My father was very religious. And the first night we were given the bread, I wouldn't even eat it because it was not kosher. But once I saw the dead children, I did everything in my power to survive. So the experiment, I want to describe basically what we were. We were little girls between the ages of 2 and 16, huddled in our filthy bunk beds that were crawling with lice and rats. We were very badly infested with lice. Within a week, we were starved for food. We were starved for human kindness. And we were starved for the love of the mothers and fathers we once had. Yet we still had an unbelievable determination to live one more day, survive one more experiment. Because that's all we could concentrate on. We couldn't concentrate on anything more. I was used in two types of experiments. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, after our brownish, lukewarm, bitter, liquid cold coffee, that was breakfast, we would be taken to a room, about 50 sets of twins, naked, for 8 hours, standing and sitting. They would measure just about every part of my body, compare it to my twin sister, and then compare it to chart. And it was very detailed measurement. They could spend 3 hours on one arm. Those experiments were not dangerous, but they were very, very demeaning.
Humiliating.
And even in Auschwitz, I had some difficulty coping with that. So after a few days of those, once we would be taken to the observation lab, what I call the observation lab, my mind would go blank because I couldn't cope with it. The other days, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, we would be taken to another lab that I call the blood lab. There they would tie both of my arms, take a lot of blood from my left arm, while at the same time giving me at least 5 injections into my right arm. Those were the deadly ones. After one of those injections, I became very ill with a very high fever. In fact, I desperately tried to hide because the rumor in the camp was that anybody got sick and taken to the hospital and they never came back. What I can just assume that happened because we don't really have enough information. Mm-hmm. The data has disappeared. Books have not been written about it.
And you must have been worried, too, if you had been sick, what would have happened to your sister?
Well, I think that at that moment, yes, but I was definitely just the fact that I did not want to die, and it was why I knew I couldn't do a lot to defeat the Nazis, but that was my way of not letting the Nazis win. If I died, then they at least they would win as far as I'm concerned. So I arrived, I was taken to the hospital after they measured my fever. And at the time, I didn't understand how did they know I was sick. But of course, they knew because they injected me with something.
They were expecting
it. At the hospital, at the hospital, it looked just like another barrack. But the people who were there looked more dead than alive. They couldn't even walk. Most of them were just in their bunk bed screaming. Mengele came in next morning with 4 other doctors. And what amazed me even then, he never examined me. He looked at my fever chart, and then he declared, kind of laughing sarcastically, he said to the other doctors, "Too bad she's so young. She has only 2 weeks to live." I knew he was right. I knew I was very ill. But again, I refused to die. So I made a second silent pledge that I will prove Mengele wrong, I will survive, and be reunited with my sister. For the following 2 weeks, I have only one clear memory, crawling on the barrack floor, because I no longer could walk, and crawling to reach the other end of the barrack, where somehow I discovered that there was a faucet with water, because this barrack was not even allocated water. people were brought there to die. And as I was crawling, I would fade in and out of consciousness. And even in a semi-conscious state of mind, I kept telling myself, I must survive. I must survive. After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and I immediately felt a lot stronger. It took me another 3 weeks. So I was in the hospital for a total of 5 weeks. And I was released and reunited with the other twins and my twin sister. Now, Miriam looked very sick, and I could not understand what happened to her. What in Auschwitz was very, I tell people, it was very easy to die. To live was a full-time job. And what would happen to people who were discouraged and give up? And what I can only assume that Miriam might have given up that I would die. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But she was injected with something. Then I asked her, what have they done to you?
What did she say?
And she said, I cannot talk about it. I will not talk about it. We didn't talk about Auschwitz until 1985. By that time, I lived in Terre Haute, Indiana. The word Auschwitz never entered our conversation.
The two of you, you never?
Never.
Mm.
So I personally, I will tell you a strange thing. I picked up, we got back to Romania after the war to our village, to our home, and everything was gone. Everything was ransacked. I found 3 crumbled pictures on a bedroom floor. I picked them up, put them in my pocket, then I put them in an envelope. I never looked at those pictures until 1978.
Mm. Now, you said your sister...
I knew it was. Mm-hmm. It was my family and us, but right. I was not able to face the past.
Oh, and now, I know that you said... you and your sister, remarkably, you and your sister survived, as we were just hearing... You all together in 1984, your twin sister Miriam and you, in Terre Haute, you started an organization to try to find...
No, my sister didn't live in Terre Haute. My sister never lived in the United States.
Right, but...
Miriam lived in Israel.
Mm.
I started the organization. I began what happened was, I began lecturing in 1978 after the Holocaust show appeared, was aired by NBC. And people kept asking me about the details of the experiments. Well, I knew a little bit about myself, but I didn't know much more about anybody else. So I began reading books about Mengele, but there was nothing about the experiments except the fact that he did experiments on twins. So then I decided that there were all these children who were filmed by the Soviet Army. They were called liberation films, and there were a couple of hundreds or quite a lot of them, and I wondered where they all survived. What if I found them, and we had a reunion, and we would share our memories? But where do I find people I have not seen in so many years? So I began a very long campaign. There was no internet, no computer, none of that. And it took me about 5.5 years when I remember in December of 1983.
Eva, I'm going to stop you for a minute there because we have to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation about your search for these twins that you're doing as part of the work that you're doing with the Candles Holocaust Museum in Terre Haute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Eva Moses-Kaur. She's a Holocaust survivor. She lives in Terre Haute, Indiana now, where she has founded the Candles Holocaust Museum. We're talking to her about her story. She's been telling us about her story, she and her sister, twins, how they were able to survive Auschwitz. Eva, you were saying just before the break about how you're traveling around, you're sharing your stories One part of your story that we haven't gotten to, and you shared this in the Chicago suburbs a couple months ago, you were speaking to students at Homewood Flossmoore High School. You were talking about forgiveness, and you have a remarkable story of you actually meeting doctors who worked with you at Auschwitz. You were able to interact with one doctor 20 years ago. What made you decide to go and meet one of the Nazi doctors who experimented on you and held you captive?
The way things evolved, actually, it wasn't my idea. It was, I was lecturing about medical ethics, which I also do in addition to forgiveness. And that doctor asked me to bring along a Nazi doctor with me. And I said, where exactly do you think I could find one of those guys? They didn't advertise in the Yellow Pages. So
right.
He said, that's funny, but I want you to think about it. And when I did think about it, I remembered the name of a doctor that appeared on a documentary that Miriam and I did a year earlier. And that is the way I contacted the filmmakers, and they gave me his telephone number. I didn't know what would happen. He refused to come to United States, to Boston, to lecture, but was willing to meet with me at his house. I was very scared about meeting a Nazi doctor.
Where did you go?
But he
Where did you go? Where was his house?
It was, he lived in Ravshaupten, about 2 hours from Munich. And we were going to film the interviews that I could take to Boston College. Well, he treated me with kindness, respect, and I was blown away by his respect that he was showing me. And the interview went very well. We finished it for my conference in Boston. And then out of the blues, I asked him if he knew anything by any chance about the operation of the gas chamber. And how interesting it was, he said that this was the nightmare that he lived with every single day of his life, that he was actually, not daily, but often stationed at the gas chamber, watching through a peephole how the gas chambers operated, and when everybody was dead, he would sign a death certificate. I have never heard about that part of the Holocaust or the gas chamber operation, so I immediately asked him to go with me to Auschwitz, because that was 1993, and 2 years later I was going to be at Auschwitz, actually a year and a half later. And he agreed with me.
So he agreed to come with you?
Yes. Now, I got back to Terre Haute, Indiana, so excited that I will have an original document, and if I ever run into a revisionist who say the Holocaust didn't happen, I could take that document and shove it in their face. But for some strange reason, I wanted to thank him, and I had no idea how to thank a Nazi doctor. And I knew it was a very unusual thing, that if I ask my friends or family, that they might convince me not to do it. And I didn't want anybody to intervene in what I wanted to do. So it took me 10 months of brainstorming. And when I was cooking, cleaning, or driving the car, I kept asking myself, how can I thank this Nazi doctor? And after 10 months, a simple idea popped into my head. How about a letter of forgiveness from me to him? I knew right away that he would like it, but what I discovered for myself was life-changing. I discovered that I had one power left after all that happened, that I had the power to forgive. No one could give it to me, and no one could take it away, and I could use it in any way I wished. For somebody like me who survived the horrors of Auschwitz, to discover that I had any power over my life was an unbelievable thing, because all victims of all tragedies feel tremendous anger, pain. They feel hopeless. They feel helpless. They feel powerless. And I discovered I had power. So it took me another 4 months to write out my letter, and then I was concerned about my spelling. And I called my former English professor, who actually lives in Charleston, Illinois, and we met about three times. And the third time she said to me, "Now, Eva, that's very nice, you forgive Dr. Munch, but your problem is not with Dr. Munch, your problem is with Dr. Mengele." I was not quite ready to do that yet, but she said to me, "It would be nice if you went home tonight and pretended I was talking to Mengele and telling him that I forgive him," because she said, "I want you to see how it would make you feel if you could do that." So that is what I did. And when I said to Mengele, I had actually a long list of nasty words I read to him. After that, I said, "In spite of all that, I forgive you." It was a very interesting feeling to realize that I, the little victim of almost 50 years, I even had power over Mengele. And there was nothing that Joseph Mengele could do to change that. Since I was not hurting anybody, I definitely could do it. And if I forgave Mengele, I forgave everybody. Now, what people...
How did, I wonder, how did that change your outlook on life, that moment?
I have dealt with that question more often than you realize. First of all, to understand when somebody is hurt by life or destiny, like we were, or any other pain, something is broken inside one's heart, soul, and spirit. Once I could forgive, I felt whole inside. I was no longer broken. People say to me, "How can you forgive the Nazis?" And I usually answer it with a question. Do I deserve to be free from what they have done to me? And the answer is, of course, yes. Well, that's what I was doing. By forgiveness, I was restoring that broken spirit to make it whole again. And each person has to do it for himself or herself. Nobody can do it for me, and I cannot do it for anybody else.
Eva, I can't help but think of everything, the events of the past couple of months, as we've seen sales of Hitler's Mein Kampf, how much it's been selling in Germany over the past year. We've been seeing reports of white nationalist movements in the United States. We've seen incidents of hate crimes. Anecdotally, we've heard about hate crimes that have happened in the U.S. over the past couple of months. In fact, there's news out of Chicago this morning about that's being investigated as a hate crime. How do you approach all of this? How do you think about that now, about the world that we're living in right now?
First of all, I detest the fact that people who are, so to speak, on the left, or people who are, so to speak, on the right, get at each other and always bring up Hitler and the Holocaust. There is no comparison. My dear, there is absolutely zero comparison. Why did Hitler rise to power? Because the United States and the government of Roosevelt, whom I dearly admired, President Roosevelt, and the rest of the world appeased Adolf Hitler. Do you know that I have here at the museum a docent who arrived from Germany as a refugee Jew in 1939? His father was questioned repeatedly by the immigration services while on the streets of New Jersey, Nazis were marching with swastikas and Nazi flags. The fact is that everybody appeased Adolf Hitler, United States included, and it was Roosevelt who did it. They were more concerned about communism than Adolf Hitler. And if United States wouldn't have been attacked at Pearl Harbor, United States would not have entered World War II. And the world would look completely different. United States definitely saved the world from the terrorists called the Nazis. What happened in recent years? United States appeased ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and everybody else. So if we want to compare anything, the right wing and the left wing ought to grow up. I lived in communist Romania. I didn't quite like it, and I don't think that we like what's going on in Cuba either. There has to be a balance between left and right. I agree on one thing, that all the Americans want people to have good jobs. They want to have good health care. They want people to respect one another. I think that name-calling and pointing fingers ought to stop. And if either president of the United States, like Obama was for 8 years, or anybody who will become president of the United States, I would intervene a couple of conferences a year on the two extreme groups, the left wing and the right group. We are all Americans. We all want the same thing for our families, for our children, for our future. I think we, instead of pointing fingers at one another, let's see what we have in common.
And is that something, I mean, in part of your museum, I wonder how much you think...
That's what we are trying to do. Mm-hmm. We are trying to teach people to respect one another. The finger pointing does not do anything good for anybody except the politicians.
And with your museum, so, right, with the work that you try...
We are trying to prevent genocide. We have even workshops for young people on human rights. As we are speaking right now here today, do you know that there are millions of people in Darfur that are still being killed and the world is doing nothing? There are people, of course, who are being killed in Syria. There are people who are being killed in Iraq and United States. There are Christians being killed by Muslims in Iraq and in the, many of these countries. There are Muslims killed. There are many Muslims killed in Syria and in other places.
So for you, Eva, for your work, I imagine you said your lesson that you want everyone to remember is to not forget, because you're saying this is happening now again and you want people to pay attention
to it. Well, I think the way not forgetting is not enough. That is, to me, it's just a slogan. I think how we remember it should be the question. Not to get even, but to prevent it. Forgiveness is the only way that people will heal themselves and still remember and stand up with good ideas to try to stop it. But we see it happening. Not by the time it gets as big as ISIS or Hitler got. Before that, we have to resolve misunderstandings, conflicts, when they are small.
Thank you for taking the time to join with us.
There is a way.
Eva, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We're speaking with Eva Moses Kaur. I should mention, each year the Candles Holocaust Museum organizes a trip for people to spend a week with her at Auschwitz for an educational tour. There's still a couple spots left, I know. We're going to send out the information, a link for that, for people who want to have more information about that. Eva, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share your story.
Thank you for being interested, and I will invite people. I'm trying to teach the world to heal through forgiveness.
Thank you, Eva. That's all the time we have for today. As I mentioned, we'll have all of those resources up at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow 21stshow on Twitter, too. We'll send out all that information, more about Eva's story. There's a documentary that's going to be released about her life. It's called Eva A7063, the number that was assigned to her, that's going to be coming out later this year. That does it for us today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.